The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Halbrooks, the Honorable Judge Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is October 31, 2024. To me, the gallery seems kind of dark today. I wonder if we have some more overhead lights.
Put light out there, yeah.
Is that the only reason? Okay. If you
the
have,
lights
if
are
the marshal,
all the way up. The
they are
all
okay.
The way up. Yep.
Good. That's fine. At least, I think in front of the bar in the well, I think we have enough light. As I said, today's date is October 31, 2024. This panel of the court today has four cases set for oral arguments, and no non-oral cases. So, four cases on our calendar for today. I will call the first case, and then we will begin. The first case is number A24-0550, Rebecca L. Bursch versus Sharon K. Hills. Counsel, I believe you're familiar with our procedures. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and then counsel for appellant will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. The lectern is adjustable in height. There's a button on the front edge or ledge of the slanted surface. I think there's two buttons, up or down, and so everyone can adjust the height of the lectern as they wish. Counsel for appellant, you may begin by introducing yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honor. Let me just adjust this quickly so I can see the court. Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Elizabeth Porter. I'm here on behalf of plaintiff appellant in this matter, Rebecca Bursch, who is also present in the courtroom. I'm glad the court addressed the lighting. I thought I was losing my mind as the lights were going up and down, and I was here praying I'm not losing my mind and everything inside of it.
Or both of us are.
Yes. Thank you. That's a relief. So, as it were, Your Honor, we are here on an interesting case, I believe a case of first impression, regarding the anti-palimony statute, specifically Minnesota Statute 513075. This requires a little bit of setup for the facts in this case because they are unique in that we're requesting that this particular statute not apply to this case. Facts in this case are contained in the first 13 pages of the appellant brief, so they are pretty significant to this matter. And I'll cover them briefly. If the court has questions, please do jump in. Our parties in this particular matter were in a long-term, 30-year same-sex relationship. This relationship began in 1992. They became a couple at a time where same-sex relationships were not necessarily welcomed or open-armed or accepted. For the first 21 years of their relationship, they were not permitted to marry. Our Minnesota Statute 517 did not acknowledge that people of same sex could enter into a contract to marry. In fact, their manner of intimacy was only recently decriminalized in May of 2023. So this is sort of an evolving area of the law. It's not a typical case of cohabitation, as Minnesota Statute 513075 anticipates, because this is not a man and a woman, and I'll talk about that in a moment. The parties throughout their relationship, they purchased a home, an older Rambler in Burnsville in 1994. Together, they paid off that home. The home is well maintained. It wasn't upgraded. They did finish the basement, but it was well maintained. They paid off the home throughout the course of their relationship. Ms. Hills, respondent in this case, was a brand new attorney at that point, brand new, just starting out. Built a successful practice over the 30-year relationship, became partnered in the firm she's in. Last known income of $350,000 in 2021. She is also, important to this case, a family law attorney as well as a city attorney, and advertises her work with cohabitating couples. And I think that becomes important in just a moment. Ms. Bursch, appellant in this case, at 1996, became permanently disabled. She was unable to continue working as an investigator in her line of work. From there on out, her income was limited to what she earned from Social Security disability. Today, that amount is $1,808 a month, $1,808 a month. In the course of the relationship, Ms. Hills made promises to Ms. Bursch to take care of her financially. Ms. Bursch took care of the homestead, kept meals on the tables.
Counsel, I appreciate the unique facts of this case and their significance to both parties involved. You know, it seems to me, however, that we're looking at a statute and how to interpret a statute. Why wouldn't we apply the canons of construction set out in 645.08 that I understand apply to construing the statutes of this state? Why wouldn't we apply those canons to the cohabitation statute?
So I believe the court is referring to the language in the cohabitation statute that says a man and a
contract
woman.
Contract between a man and a woman.
Right. So I believe that we look at the man and woman. That is very specific. We have men, we have women. The canons of construction, well,
it says that words of one gender include the other gender.
Your Honor, when I think of that particular instruction in the canons of construction, I think about all men are created equal. I interpret that to mean me too. That includes me as a woman, that I am included in that. But when the statute says men and women, we are specifically including men and women and not saying those of both gender. I think on its face, the statute applies to men and women. The more important piece of that statute that we are taking issue with today is the out of wedlock piece. That was not available to this couple from the start of their relationship in 92 until 12:01 a.m. on August 1, 2013. That's when they are permitted to marry. So for the first 21 years, the building phase of this relationship, the pay down of the mortgage, the purchase of a property in Wisconsin, the putting money into retirement for our retirement, those are the words that were used, that's happening during a time that these parties are forbidden from marrying. And so I believe the cohabitation statute, that is our client's position, the cohabitation statute can't possibly apply to it applies to men and women in a relationship, not women and women in a relationship, not men and
men
in a relationship.
About promises made after 2013, would your argument change?
Your Honor, I missed the very first part.
Well, what about contracts or promises made after August 1st, 2013? Would your argument be the same, that the cohabitation statute simply does not apply because when it says man and woman, it's the distinction between the two that's critical?
Your Honor has hit the nail on the head as to why we're here today. So we need some direction from the court about this cohabitation statute. Because what happens to the people who weren't in line at the courthouse, same-sex relationships, that wanted to marry and were not there on August 1, 2013, but had a 20-year relationship up to that point? What happens to their property they accumulated if they don't get married until 2015 because their family can't be here? Or they wait till it's federally recognized, another right not guaranteed but in the current circumstances, if Roe v. Wade is any indication, Obergefell may be overturned. We don't know that. But what happens to those people who had a long-term relationship but did not elect to marry on August 1, 2013? We need that information from the court. That's part of why this case becomes so important, is to determine how do we address that as the family bar when we have people coming in who didn't marry until later. In this case, the parties never married.
Ms. Porter, I'd like to, yes. One more follow up. I'd like to follow up on Judge Bjorkman's question about interpreting the statute. Part of the district court's reasoning was, I think, based on the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, trying to avoid an interpretation that might violate the Equal Protection Clause, and respondent has argued that in respondent's brief as well. Is that not a valid reason to interpret the statute to apply here?
Your Honor, that's an excellent question, and I don't have a canned answer for that other than does the Equal Protection Clause only apply one direction in this case, or does my client get equal protection as well? This is, if you look at the facts of this case, a 30-year relationship where one party has accumulated everything and the other has nothing but stayed because of promises that were made. Where are her protections is my question to the Equal Protection Clause. The person who knew the most about the cohabitation clause is a party in this action, and it's not my client. It's the family law attorney who advertises work with the cohabitation clientele. That, I think, is the problem, is that my client walked out as a disabled, vulnerable adult with nothing but half of the equity in the house. She has nothing in retirement. She didn't earn the income that her partner of 30 years earned. She didn't make the promises that her partner of 30 years promised. So now to pull...
Do you think those facts would overcome a constitutional challenge by somebody in Ms. Hill's position who might say, I should have the benefit of this statute in just the same way that a heterosexual person should?
I think the problem with that is the statute couldn't have applied when wedlock wasn't available. So I think, you know, if we're looking at just the period of time from August 1, 2013 to the breakup, possibly, but I think that's unfair considering the bulk of the property is accumulated in the first 21 years when neither individual has the benefit of statute or Minnesota Statute 518, where we equitably divide.
Okay, thank you. Before we go further, I feel like we should address the respondent's first argument is that we need not even address the statute because that there were the district court had alternative bases. First, the statute. Second, the underlying merits of the causes of action, and that in your opening brief, you did not challenge the latter. And so the respondent argues that we could affirm on that ground alone, it's unchallenged. And I don't think you directly responded or replied to that argument in your reply brief. So could you please tell us your position on that issue?
Sure. Your Honor, as I recall, the argument was a motion to strike, if I'm in-
Well, I'm thinking about the response. The argument in respondent's brief, brief point one says, the district court's grant of partial SJ was proper even without reference to the statutes, and that's because you waived a challenge to the district court's analysis of the causes of action.
So my reading of the district court's order, the summary judgment order, is that the anti-palimony statute was sort of the shadow by which everything else was decided. If you read the order, there are several references to the anti-palimony statute, even as the district court goes through each individual claim and dismisses it one by one. The issue I think we run into then is if we have the anti-palimony statute as sort of the umbrella, to use a term applicable today, we use that as an umbrella to dismiss the remaining claims, and then we dismiss each individual claims. How does a client in Ms. Bursch's position get a remedy in a case like this, where 30 years she puts blood, sweat, and tears in and has to walk out with nothing?
Well, so, my question is focused on the fact, I think the district court had two bases for granting respondent's motion. One was the statute, two was the merits of the causes of action, given the evidence in the record. And I think having agreed with respondent movement on both, I think the duty was on you to challenge both of those grounds for summary judgment. But you challenged only one, the statute.
Right. That seemed to be the primary focus of the district court, that this case could not have proceeded because of the anti-palimony statute.
I think you're right, primary, because the district court addressed it first, right. But the district court also went to the merits then.
Well, and that's, I think, where summary judgments becomes a problem in this case, Your Honor. So we didn't get to have an evidentiary hearing on the merits of this case. We didn't get to present.
Well, it's a motion for summary judgment.
Right. So the court is only working with a very small portion of the entire fact of this case. And then the court issued an opinion that essentially leans into heavily this anti-palimony statute saying this cannot proceed because of this. And then even if we set that aside and the court makes multiple references to the anti-palimony statute. But there really aren't. I practiced for 22 years. I'm not aware of any other remedies we could bring to get people in Ms. Bursch's position some relief under a case like this.
Well, let's assume we agree with you that you did not forfeit your arguments that the respondent is not entitled to judgment as a matter of law as to the merits. What is the evidence that you put forth at the summary judgment stage to create a genuine issue of material fact on the various causes of action?
So, Your Honor, the primary evidence we had is literally hundreds of cards and letters written over the course of the 30-year relationship. Some were during the active relationship, some were more towards the end. There were audios of Ms. Hill saying, I'm not going to leave you penniless. I'm going to help you. It was getting those in front of the court. There were... And I've included several of the quotations in my brief. I've pulled several of them for the court, if the court wants to hear some. But it's statements in cards, anniversary cards, Christmas cards, letters written from the heart from Ms. Hills to Ms.
Birch. And the district court, as I understood, or concluded that there were not definite promises, right? That there was not an enforceable promise. Why is the district court wrong as to that?
Well, I think the district court needed to take some testimony from the clients to understand what that meant. When we're proposing to each other, when we're wearing wedding bands during the course of our relationship, I believe those are promises. In heterosexual couples, if we exchange wedding bands, that is considered a promise. These parties, they exchanged wedding bands, yet somehow or another, I disagree with the district court, respectfully, that was not seen as a promise. And I think that that was an error to make that ruling, especially without allowing the case to proceed to trial where evidence and testimony could be taken before making a ruling that of such. It was unfortunate that those particular claims were dismissed in summary judgment, and quite unfair to my client, who never really got to be heard on why she's making those claims. There is a myriad of writings making claims of, I will take care of you. I love you to the end. Here's just a couple I've pulled out for the court's reference. I want to spend the rest of my life with you. Yes, you read that right. I want to spend the rest of my life with you. Are you certain that you want and will to spend the rest of your life with me? I'm certain, more than I have ever been. I know this is what I want. In the spring of 1994, we made a major commitment and moved into and have been working on our full house. I made this commitment to you, to us, because I saw forever in your eyes. This is Ms. Hills to Ms. Birch. 1996, when Ms. Birch becomes...
Are you aware of any case law that would support a determination that those kinds of romantic statements, those kinds of promises, if you will, are sufficient to create a contract, an enforceable contract?
So, Your Honor, I'm going to pull a statement out of another case that I've heard. I think we have to look at the totality of the circumstances to determine if a contract existed. And it's not just the statements. It's also the party's conduct. It's exchanging wedding rings. It's referring to each other as wife. Will you marry me? It's accepting those, yes, I will marry you, the proposals, when the law wouldn't accept those. It's the behavior of the party that we have to look at in addition to the statements made to determine did a contract exist. Were there promises made? Was there reliance upon those promises? And the other claims that are made in this particular case. And I think those are facts that need to be determined by the district court before simply being dismissed on summary judgment. My client has no other remedy. She can't get in because of anti-palimony, and she can't get in because the judge says, well, I don't think there's enough evidence. In a summary judgment motion, this should have been, there's a difference between a summary judgment motion and an evidentiary hearing or a trial. At that point, we are offering evidence and testimony for the court to consider. Your Honor, I do see that my red light is blinking. Do I wrap it up or do you have other questions? I'm sorry. I got into it.
You will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Okay.
And you may summarize at that time.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry I missed that. It's you need to make it bigger, so.
That's okay.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Susan Dodelin. With me today at council table is my colleague, Mylene Landry, and together we represent the respondent, Sharon Hills. In its order for partial summary judgment, the district court recognized that it is not this court's role to step in for the legislature to make new, broad social policy that contravenes existing, valid statutes. Now, this court's role today is to correct any errors that the lower court might have made. But here, the district court correctly applied the law, concluded that there are no genuine issues of material fact, and determined that Ms. Hills was entitled to judgment as a matter of law on all of Ms. Birch's claims that did not involve the party's jointly owned home, their joint home equity line of credit, and their personal property. Those limited remaining claims were tried, and the district court awarded each party an equitable share of the proceeds from the sale of their partitioned property. We ask this court to affirm the decisions of the district court in their entirety. Now, a lot of brief pages and pages in the district court's summary judgment order are devoted to whether the cohabitation statutes apply to the parties in this case. or if they should be interpreted to apply to same-sex couples, such that Bursch's claims against Hills are barred. Now, in coming back to this question while I prepared for today's argument, I was really struck by how simple this issue actually is in the context of this case. Undisputed fact, the parties did not get married after the legislature amended the statutes to allow same-sex couples to marry. And undisputed fact, too, the parties never entered into a written contract that included terms concerning their property and financial relationship.
So our Supreme Court said, I think in the Pullman case, that the purpose of the cohabitation statute is to prevent unmarried couples from enjoying the same rights as married couples.
That's correct.
So that doesn't really apply to the parties here, at least prior to August 1st, 2013. If the purpose was to penalize, if you will, people for not getting married, that wouldn't be fair as applied to these parties prior to August 2013, would it?
Well, it is correct. They were unable to avail themselves of wedlock.
Why shouldn't the court distinguish between promises allegedly made, contracts allegedly, oral contracts allegedly entered into before August 2013? Why shouldn't we view those in a different light than we do to alleged promises and commitments made after that date?
Well, I think it's important that in the intervening years, I mean, certainly in 2013, the parties could have married had they elected to. If they had married after 2013, Ms. Bursch would be able to go into family courts and make claims for property. And Ms. Hills could have said, well, this was my property amassed prior to the marriage. That's my non-marital property. The statutes, the dissolution statutes, would have allowed Ms. Bursch to present an equitable argument as to why the court should invade some portion of Ms. Hill's non-marital property and award it to her. So had they gotten married, she would have had a remedy to try and recover what she believes she may be entitled to for the years prior to the party's marriage that otherwise, wouldn't have been part of the marital estate. It's significant that in 2013, when Ms. Bursch asked Ms. Hills to marry her, Ms. Hills declined. It seems to me that someone should have thought at that point in time, well, if my beloved does not want to get married, what does that mean for me in terms of the rest of my life, our relationship? How do I protect myself?
The record, I think, indicates additional statements of promise to remain together after 2013. Doesn't it include such evidence?
Well, it's correct that the record includes, hundreds if not thousands of pages of cards and letters written by Ms. Hills to Ms. Bursch. But I am aware of no authority that says a promise to marry is an enforceable contract, that a promise to stay together and love you for the rest of my life is an enforceable promise.
Take care of you financially. Is that getting closer to an enforceable promise?
Well, then no, Your Honor, it does not. Not absent the extra step of getting married.
Or getting that agreement in writing.
Or going with the written contract, which the parties certainly don't have here. Now, the fact that they didn't get married and the fact that there is no written contract ever, either prior to 2013 or after, means that Ms. Bursch's claims against Ms. Hills fall squarely within the purview of 513.076, which requires a court to dismiss claims by an individual to the earnings or property of another individual if those claims are based on the fact that the individuals live together in a cohabiting sexual relationship out of wedlock, unless they've entered into the contract that's described in section 513.075. 0.076 is written with no reference to a man or a woman. It is written in the most gender-neutral language possible, and it refers to individuals. these individuals did not enter into a written contract required under 075.
Well, I understand that 076 talks about individuals. 075 talks about a man and a woman.
Yes, it does. So if the parties had purported to sign a written contract that outlined their financial relationship and what would happen if the relationship ended, then maybe we'd be here today arguing about whether the man and woman referred to in 075 means that that written contract couldn't be enforced because we don't have a man and a woman. But we don't have a contract. There is no reason for 0.075 to enter into the discussion here today. 0.076 takes care of it because there is no written contract under 0.075.
Ms. Dolvin, I'm sorry to interrupt. I want to go back just a little bit to, could you help me understand the hundreds or thousands of cards, letters, statements, alleged promises, and so on? Can you characterize sort of the volume or proportion of those that were before 2013 as opposed to after 2013? I guess I'm thinking of the statements on which appellant is relying for the causes of action. Were those made in the post-2013 era or before?
I believe the certainly earlier in their party's relationship, the more loving and effusive and romantic the parties were towards one another. And so the earlier cards and letters contain more of that loving, I want to live with you for the rest of my life, I will take care of you. As the relationship, you know, delved towards the end and the love perhaps soured, there's less of that. So I would say that earlier in the relationship, those promises were maybe more prolific.
Thank you.
And all of it was before the district court. I would like to point out that in response to Ms. Hill's motion for summary judgment, Ms. Hill's summary judgment motion contained probably 3 inches, possibly, of materials, including all of the cards and letters, copies of the transcribed recordings of verbal conversations the parties had. All of that was presented to the district court by Ms. Hills on summary judgment. In response, Ms. Bursch did not argue about the causes of action, didn't argue about whether the facts in the record met the elements of each of her claims such that summary judgment was not appropriate. She didn't discuss her causes of action at all. All she did was argue that the cohabitation statutes don't apply.
She seems to be saying, as I understood part of appellant's argument, that she wanted the opportunity to testify to those things.
Well, that's not what that's not what happens at a summary judgment phase, Your Honor.
I understand that, but it's
the obligation of the non-moving party to bring forward the facts, the evidence, the information that would show the district court that there was a dispute of material fact, and that if the facts or the evidence is viewed in the light most favorable to her, that a court could reasonably conclude that she's entitled to some relief under one or more of her claims. And
It seemed like the parties basically produced the same information.
Correct.
These notes,
correct. I'm unaware of any significant dispute about any material fact here. To the extent that there's any dispute about whether the rings each of them had were really wedding rings or if it was, Ms. Hills has said, okay, for purposes of summary judgment, for purposes of today's argument, let's accept that as true in the light most favorable to Ms. Bursch. And even if they did exchange rings as a token of commitment to one another, that still does not get Ms. Bursch over the hump of summary judgment, and it doesn't affect her claims about contracts or unjust enrichment or intentional infliction of emotional distress. Everything that could have been before the district court was thoughtfully considered by the district court. The order has a summary of facts most favorable to plaintiff, which Ms. Bursch did not challenge in her appellant's brief to this court. Her appellant's brief said that the facts of this are undisputed, and so I wrote my response accordingly. And then in her reply brief, after I've said, well, you didn't challenge the summary, you know, the elemental part of the summary judgment order, so that argument should be waived and this court should affirm, only then did she start to argue about whether, you know, there was a contract or unjust enrichment applies. And, you know, so I have moved to have that reply brief stricken because those are arguments that should have been made in the first instance.
To the extent she's responding to the merits as you discussed in your respondent's brief, would you agree the case law does sort of carve out an exception to the forfeiture doctrine when an appellant is responding to something respondent's brief?
I don't agree with that in this case, Your Honor. The fact that we pointed out that she omitted a significant argument about the district court's decision, and therefore her argument on that should be deemed waived, the response to that cannot then be, oh, well, here's what I have to say about that issue. She's the appellant. It's her obligation to raise all of her claims about any errors the district court might have made in her case in chief, not to throw it in as a reply. That said, Your Honor, even her reply brief really fails to hone in on any fact that was in the record that she believes the district court did not consider in reaching its decision on any of the claims that she made. The district court's order is very thorough, considers all of the alleged promises, goes through all the elements of each claim, concludes that the promises weren't sufficiently specific to constitute offers to enter into a contract. Certainly nothing in the record shows that Ms. Bursch accepted any of the purported offers, and that Ms. Bursch didn't provide any consideration in exchange for any purported offer. Under these circumstances and there's no reason here to exclude these parties from the case law and the statutes concerning these sorts of claims in a cohabitation situation. And the Erickson case, the Pullman case, the Herlosh case all consistently say that where a cohabitant has put in her own money into property, she's entitled to make a claim to recover that property. And that's what Ms. Bursch was allowed to do in this case to the extent she put money into the party's Burnsville home. She was allowed to take that to trial and recover her share of that. The rest of the claims were properly disposed of by the district court. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Dodlin. Ms. Porter, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I mean, the position from my perspective and my client's perspective is the district court was simply wrong in awarding summary judgment outside of the anti-palimony statute. That's why we're here today, is asking for some direction on that, because this will not be the first time this comes up now that we have acknowledgement of same-sex marriage.
But you do concede you did not argue the merits of the substance of the summary judgment decision. Mm-hmm.
So my primary brief was mostly about the anti-palimony statute, because I believe that's how the court dismissed this entire case, was saying it can't be brought because the anti-palimony statute prohibits it. And so that's the primary issue we're getting to. My client couldn't get past that if it applies to this case, and I would submit that it should not apply to same-sex individuals because it's unfair the way that happens. then we couldn't get to the other remedies. We couldn't get to the other claims that she made because we were barred from the start. I believe the district court was in error. I did reply in the brief to the appellant, I'm sorry, the respondent's brief regarding those particular elements because it was raised in that in the respondent's brief. I don't believe that's a new issue. I believe that is an issue that existed when we came up here on the Court of Appeals. I believe a new issue would be something like we're responding to all of those items and asking for a new judicial officer at district court. That is a new issue we are not requesting. I needed to respond. That was the time to do the response. I believe had the anti-palimony statute not been applicable to this case or not been applied, we would not be standing here today. We might have at least gone through the district court trial and been able to present evidence and testimony to our judge about why there was a contract, what the promises were, how my client relied upon those, why it's different for same-sex individuals over opposite-sex individuals who had rights that same-sex individuals simply did not have.
What are the genuine issues of material fact that you can direct us to?
Your Honor, I would actually
constitute an error that the district court did not recognize.
If we take a look at the actual brief, the complaint itself, Your Honor, I think whether or not there was a contract and what were the terms, those are issues of fact the court has to decide. The court decided there wasn't.
Specifically in this case, what was evidence of a genuine issue of material fact?
Well, I think pretty much anything tied to the complaint itself with regard to contract. Was there an implied contract? Was there a breach of contract? Does these writings, and I'm pointing to my brief as though I have the writings, I do not, but the multitude of writings, the thousands of pages, along with the party's conduct, does that constitute a contract? Did the parties engage in a contract? Was there offer and acceptance? Was consideration the fact that my client stayed? She stayed. She was told, we don't need to get married back. We're already married. She was in a relationship with an attorney who works with these matters every single day. She believed her partner. She was there as a vulnerable, disabled adult, staying in a relationship she thought was technically a marriage. And now she's finding out that it's not. Those are facts that are in dispute. Those are facts the judge needed to make a finding on to decide, was there a breach? Was there a contract? Was it breached? Was it implied? Was it written? Was there detrimental reliance? Were there promises made that were not kept? And those are things that were submitted through our side as we responded to the summary judgment motion. We didn't file our own summary judgment motion. We filed a response to theirs, trying to keep the case alive, to get it into district court, to get it into the chambers of the trial court, to have it decided on the facts and on the evidence, not kicked out because the anti-palimony statute applies. I think we can't treat this relationship the same way we do cohabitating couples who had the right to marry, who had different rights than these parties do. This case should have been decided differently, Your Honor. That's why I'm here today, is I believe the district court made a mistake. I believe the district court was working with a situation the court had not yet seen. These aren't cases that we're seeing come up yet. Now that you're going to start seeing them coming in, we need a line of case law that tells us how to handle them.
What rule would you have us announce if we agree with you that this is a case of first impression as to how the cohabitation statute works under these circumstances? What would our rule of law be?
Your Honor, I think that's an excellent question. I would defer to the court's discretion. However, I think Colorado did a great job in addressing this very same issue by saying we're going to treat same-sex marriage like common law. We're going to, because there was a time where the parties couldn't marry, we want to know what their behavior was then. Did they appear to the outside world in a safe manner, acknowledging that same-sex individuals cannot engage in the same behavior that opposite-sex people can out in public and not put their safety at risk? But they wanted to take a look at that and see, does it look like a marriage? Does it match the elements of common law marriage? That's one way to do it. The other way is to say, you know what? We're not using anti-palimony statute in this situation. I'm looking for relief from my client, but I'm looking for relief for everybody else in this situation as well. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Porter. Thank you to both parties for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.